The Sky News Centre at 7. Greta Thunberg has told a climate strike march in Bristol that we're being betrayed by world leaders who are failing us.
But we will not back down. And if you feel threatened by that, then I have some very bad news for you. We will not be silenced, because we are the change, and change is coming whether you like it or not.
The 17-year-old also claimed those in power are behaving like children. It's thought tens of thousands of people attended the event and subsequent march through the city.
If you think all politicians are the same and your vote doesn't count, then don't listen to BCFM Politics Show. Local, national and global news with me, Tony Gosling. Every Friday from 6 till 8pm here on BCFM 93.2. and bcfmradio.com, a Bristol take on world politics.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Yes, Henry Mancini sucking us through the evening. It is after 7 o'clock here on Bristol Community 93.2 FM. I'm Billy Quain, broadcasting live across Bristol in the hot seat for Tony Gosling, who's gone in his holly halls. This is The Politics Show, and we're worldwide on bcfmradio.com. If you'd like to contact me this evening, and I would welcome that. I would positively encourage it. Studio at bcfmradio.com is the email address, or you can send me a text message. I like those. Oh, I like that too. Because they come with a digital thumbprint. So if you're abusive, I can track you down. 60777 is the number. Start it with BCFM. Come straight through to me in the studio. Martin Summers, in the second hour, what are we going to discuss?
Well, you were suggesting earlier, Billy, that we're going to discuss some international affairs, face-off between the Turkish army and the Syrian army in Idlib province, and I thought we were also going to discuss some other matters more closer to home.
Indeed, including trading one former merchant banker as Chancellor of the Exchequer for another. Interesting move, that. I wonder if the apple falls that far from the tree. We'll see. Dr. David Jewell is still with us. David, we've discussed your dietary habits. Do you feel a balanced diet is going to immunise one against the worst effects of coronavirus?
Well, I'm really sorry to disappoint you, Billy. But I think the effect that your diet has on your immune system, I think, is not very great. I mean, the interesting thing to me about nutrition is everybody talks about diet, but the science behind it is at very primitive level indeed. And the only advice I would give anybody is to repeat the advice of an American nutritionist. He says he only knows three things about diet. He says, eat real food, so which means fresh stuff and not very processed things. Eat real food, small amounts, mostly plants. Don't know whether that affects anybody's immune system, but that's kind of the healthy option.
I like it. There's a succinct elegance about that. Fabian Breckles is in the studio. Labour councillor for St. George Troopers Hill, who is on the planning committee. Lot of rain recently. Let's talk about houses on floodplains. That will be coming up anon.
Yep.
And we'll be talking about the leader, or the election of your next glorious leader.
Yeah.
Do you know where your money is?
On leadership?
Yeah.
I've already voted for Keir Starmer. He came to a rally in Bristol, very convincing. I went to the hustings. There was a Bristol hustings of all the leadership candidates and all the deputy leadership candidates. And for me, you know, as he's actually said, people are dying because we didn't win the last election. Austerity will continue. Nothing will be done to help the poor. We've still got people in working poverty. You know, nurses going to food banks because they can't actually put food on the table because their pay is so low. So, you know, people continue to suffer, and the only way we can stop that is to win an election, start turning things around.
With your hand on your heart,
mm-hmm.
did you deserve to win the last election?
I can see why we didn't. I wanted us to, but I can see why we didn't.
Okay. That's a politician's riposte. I'd like to welcome to the studio now a very special guest. Jay, 10 years living and working in Bristol. You have a story to tell. How are you this evening, most especially? We'll start there.
I'm doing well, thank you.
Have you had a productive week in the office, dear?
My body's telling me I have.
What is it that it is that you do to put bread on the table?
Carpenter/handyman.
You see, this is exactly the kind of individual we need, an artisan craftsman at the coalface of keeping the city ticking over. Mm-hmm. Jay, tell me a story about your living arrangements.
I've lived in various different abodes over the last 10 years. That ranges from houses to vehicles, no caravans, nothing wrong with caravans, but vehicles with wheels and boats. Well, one boat.
What was your favourite?
It's definitely to do with context, I think. Living on a boat is beautiful, but it's very difficult. And I think you can only sort of understand that once you've really lived on one for a while. The logistics of normal day-to-day life become a lot more complicated. That means like waste, water, heating, electricity, all these things. Things we take for granted. It definitely makes you more connected to all of those things. I think the same goes for being in a vehicle as well, but because you're able to move it around quite easily, because there's roads everywhere, and also you're kind of nearer sort of places where you get your resources from, it's actually a little bit easier, I'd say.
Okay. Fabian, how many van dwellers does the council think are living, how many people on boats, vans, caravans are living on the streets of Bristol at the moment?
If you'd asked me before the show, I'd have found out, got someone to tell me. I certainly know when I walk to work, you know, if you walk past, you know, Greenbank, there's plenty of van dwellers, there's, you know, plenty of places where there are van dwellers. And I think a lot of it's a symptom of the housing crisis. There are, of course, people who live in houseboats, and that's a permanent arrangement, and you can buy them as fully kitted out homes.
And you pay per mooring per foot for a houseboat?
You pay mooring fees, yes.
Yeah, and is council tax additional to that, or do boat and van dwellers pay no council tax?
Did you pay council tax on either?
No. So with the when you're on a boat, you pay for your licence fee, which is basically the kind of equivalent of council tax, because that money's gone towards upholding the river and the sort of facilities along the river.
And you can vary the type of licence fee you pay according to how much access you want, isn't it?
Yeah, so if you've got continuous cruising, then you have mooring. I believe if you have mooring in a sort of a permanent basis, you don't actually have to pay for the licence to continue cruising, but then you can't cruise, I think. Okay. I might have that wrong slightly.
And the licence to cruise
that
is to the...
Right. I remember having a conversation with someone else who's a boat dweller, and that sounds about right, that you the kind of license you purchase is with a boat.
Yeah, from the canal and river cluster.
Yeah, determines what rights you have on the waterways, whether it's just to moor the boat and leave it there or move it around.
Yeah.
Or move it on some waterways but not others.
Okay, slightly arcane. And then during your van dwelling phase, you have to have it MOT'd and it has to be insured.
And taxed. So,
okay.
Yeah, taxed, MOT'd and insured. There has been instances where I've rented private land and I've put the vehicle on the private land, and there's been times where I've stayed in the vehicle right outside where I've worked when I've had a workshop. Currently, there is a group in Bristol that have come together. They're called Vehicles for Change. It's essentially a community that set up a CIC, and they've set up a Patreon page. And the Patreon page is essentially a group it's a place where people who live in vehicles can go to, and based on their vehicle's value, they can give a certain amount a year, and then at the end of each month the community votes on which Bristol charity or organisation that money goes to. The reason this was done is because the group did some research on whether or not it was possible for the people living in vehicles to pay council tax, and the council told them that they weren't able to. So this was like a kind of like a crafty alternative to doing that. So they've currently already got some funders, and it's sort of growing sort of incrementally.
Okay. Do you have any idea how many people are living in vans, caravans and other forms of temporary accommodation across the city?
So there's been a lot of discussions about this. I think in terms of vans and vehicles, the official figure given back by the council was around 200. But I think that between the community that is discussed, it could be possibly around 800 people.
Mm-hmm. I can well believe it. I live in Seamills, so I cross the Downs, and the residence part, you know, the limit of where you can leave a vehicle is on the far side of the Downs now. And there's, I would estimate, between 3 and 4 dozen vehicles every night. And I think there are people sleeping in them every night, probably more than one in most.
Yeah, and I walk past them to work. When I go to work, I walk past vans that are and caravans that are clearly lived in. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's, I mean, some of it might be by choice, but a lot of it is necessity, economic necessity, because the people in them literally cannot afford anything else.
What is the council doing to mitigate the affordability issue with entry-level housing for young professionals?
A lot of what we can do is skewed by planning laws. For example, if a developer wants to build properties, you know, there is a policy of 40% affordable within the inner city, 30% affordable in a development, larger development in the outer city. But the way the law works, it's more important for the developer to make a profit than it is for them to provide the affordables. So that means that if they can argue, they can have sort of argue that it's not profitable for them to provide enough affordable homes, they can wiggle out of it, and there's not much we as a planning authority can do. One example, the chocolate factory, the big development that's starting to happen in just off the cycle path.
Yeah, down at the old Elizabeth Fry factory at Greenbank.
That's correct.
Yeah.
We said as a planning committee, everyone, you know, had Acorn and everything at the planning committee saying, you know, they're only offering 4 affordable units. It's an absolute joke. Third out, so we did. So along comes the planning inspector and gives them the go-ahead with 0 affordable housing units.
Okay.
So the whole process, the whole planning process at the moment is very much stacked against us. Sometimes we can find we're forced to grant something that we don't want to, but we've got absolutely no chance if we take it to appeal. A recent example there was, we had a year or so ago, we approved a scheme to bring a site in Portland Square back, restore some grade one listed buildings that have been derelict since the war. It was going to be a modern flat development, so provide housing, a sustainable location, provide housing for people. If you lived and worked in the city, you could literally walk a few minutes to work and everything. Brilliant. Only recently they came back and said, well, actually, that's not profitable enough. We want to flip it over to student accommodation, and there's nothing we could do to stop it. So we had to grant it, but we made it very, very clear that none of us were happy.
Student housing also doesn't need to conform to the same homes of multiple occupancy rules.
And they don't pay council tax, so it's...
Yeah.
Well, it's true they don't.
Well, no, I'm aware of that, but
that
you know they are paying
£55,000
for half a tuition as it stands. Students no longer exist. You now have educational customers.
Yeah, and part of the problem with the student accommodation is that the University of Bristol has decided they were going to just expand their numbers because they're a business, get more foreign students in because they pay more, and you know, that's that. And so they're coming, and we have to find accommodation for them.
We're not
paying for it, but we've got to...
We'll come back to the student issue shortly, because a city the size of Bristol, there is nearly, if you include City of Bristol College and some of the other third level, there's nearly 100,000 students in the city, and that's a significant portion of the population. Jay, I'd like to go back to your story presently. David is here, works at the Horfield Medical Centre. You don't have a permanent address at the moment, other than your workshop. Do you struggle, and do you and your cohort struggle to access things like healthcare?
No, that hasn't been a problem in the past because of previous addresses that I've, for example, friends that own houses and stuff like that. So we've used that as a kind of way to have an address. And I think that when it's when it comes to healthcare, you know, friends with those addresses are completely happy to provide that sort of service, I would say. And I think I speak for a lot of people that don't have permanent addresses also have a similar thing going on, I think. Yeah.
What is the principal grievance that you encounter amongst your social coterie and indeed the other van dwellers that you encounter across the city?
The biggest grievance at the moment is the way that the I wouldn't say it's the council in general, but it's the way the current policy that has been appointed for dealing with people living in vehicles has been carried out. It's been very aggressive, and actually it's quite pertinent because yesterday or the day before someone was displaced and they were homeless on the street and lost. They were told by the company that collected their vehicle that it had been crushed with all their possessions in it. Ironically, they ended up calling up social services, and social services then had to sort of appoint a team or resources to them. So it's essentially like passing the baton.
Who crushed it? Was it the road taxation people?
Well, they haven't actually crushed it. So that was due to Vehicles for Change. Were very proactive and did some research and found out where the vehicle was. The vehicle was about to be crushed by the company. I think it was Hinton's, I think, but they were very compassionate. And once they heard, they actually weren't aware that the vehicle was lived in. They'd just been contracted by the council to come and collect it, and they were very compassionate and actually put the vehicles aside in their yard so that the owners could come and collect all of their possessions from those vehicles.
Do we know why the vehicle was removed in the first place?
Yeah, so I mean, I think what's acknowledged by myself and certainly a lot of other people in the vehicle dwelling community is that there is definitely a strain and disturbance caused by the quantity of vehicles, especially when they're in residential areas. And there is an effort amongst certain people to try and reduce that effect. I think that in this particular area where this vehicle was removed, there was a significant strain on the local residents, and they were probably complaining a lot to the council. The council have got a policy where they have essentially like three impact levels, and they have a low impact, medium impact, and high impact. And then they have two ways of sort of dealing with these encampments, they call them, and that can be through an injunction or through a PSPO, which is essentially putting a blanket ban on the area. This guy was, I think, in a group of people that had all had notices. The main sort of I think aggressive part of it, if you will, was the fact that he was told he had 24 hours to remove the vehicle, and then went to go and try and find someone to tow the vehicle, and in that time they came and towed it without him knowing. So it was like, I think he felt quite deceived.
Okay. Fabian, is this a story you hear often?
It's not much of a problem. It's not a problem in my area at all. We haven't had, you know, where I represent, and obviously it's something that should be being raised with the local councillors and in the wards where the van dwellers are. And I think that's, I'm assuming those conversations are happening.
They are happening. I think that perhaps, I mean, my own personal interpretation is that there was the net enforcement team are kind of following orders, and they are generally very compassionate because they're dealing with people on the street. But I think that there is perhaps some kind of there's perhaps a bit of surprise of how organised the community is. And actually the correspondence has been quite low, but I think it's maybe because it's kept them on their toes and they're having to make sure that they communicate the right things. It's a very, from what I understand, it's a very complicated sort of legal procedure because they have to prove that a vehicle is abandoned. Now, it's very easy to do that with a caravan because it's not necessarily registered to the DVLA. Mm-hmm. So caravans get removed quite easily. But with vehicles, it's very difficult because they're joined to a person. So right now, a lot of us are questioning, you know, what how do you define what is abandoned, and how do you define what is high impact? I think that's
what's the solution, because I know when they cleared out at Greenbank, there was space made available at Avonmouth, which people scoff at, but actually it has fantastic transport links. You are on the Severn Beach line, you've got the park and ride bus coming in, there's a cycle path runs all the way in along the portway. Would you choose to live in Avonmouth if you were given hassle-free existence down there?
I know the site. Unfortunately, it's a very nasty bit of land next to a massive pylon. And a lot of the concern of the people there was being under this really buzzing pylon. I don't know about the effects of that. I'm sure there's none. Also, there was a big problem in the fact that another traveller community came to the people living on that site. Now, this is anecdotal. This wasn't me. They came to the site and were threatening the people on there because they said it was their land. And it caused a bit of a social rift. And those people had just come from Greenbank, and they just needed somewhere to go. They had no intention of stepping on anyone's toes, but sort of did.
Okay, let's talk about solutions. Before we get on to that, would you, by choice, live in a house, or do you enjoy the freedom of van and boat dwelling? Because there seems to be a tangible sense of community.
There is a tangible sense of community. I think essentially a lot of the people who live in vehicles, it's not a homogenous group. There's a lot of different people, so it's never possible to paint the whole community with one brush. I mean, I know sort of a physiotherapist, a paramedic, I know students, I know artists, I know other people like tradesmen. There's all kinds of different people living in vehicles. But a lot of the people living in vehicles are creatives. And I think that the nature of being a creative person, if you're sort of your endeavours are perhaps quite artistic and abstract and not necessarily going to bring you revenue.
Mortgageable. That's the word you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. Then, and for example, you know, a lot of the people who perform in the Hippodrome or in the theatre shows that we like to enjoy, they, you know, these people are living in these vehicles in the sites, and people tend to forget that. So that's the cross section of this community is massive, but there are a lot of creatives, and I think that one of the things is it alleviates a lot of the pressures that living in a house currently, unless you perhaps have a good mortgage, it alleviates some of those pressures, so you have a bit more time available. And I heard of someone the other day. They just said to me, "I just want to enjoy the same amount of free time that my grandparents did," and that really sort of stuck with me. And I thought, that was quite relevant, really.
Very nicely put. Although the cynic in me would say you have to go out and win a war first to earn that leisure time. Fabian, what do the council think? What's the sentiment about this phenomenon? It is a phenomenon that has occurred in the last 10-15 years. I mean, people have always lived on boats, but seeing people living year round now on the streets in vehicles is something new.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's obviously better than sleeping rough and sleeping shop doorways, and we've seen an explosion in homelessness and an explosion in, you know, people are getting poorer and house prices keep on rocketing, and that makes housing less and less affordable. I think what it seems to me that what needs to happen is there needs to be more conversations between the council, van dwellers and any local residents to try and find ways forward. I mean, obviously, you know, sites, you know, if they can, if, you know, safe sites, whether they're at Avonmouth or elsewhere, we may need to get government funding for that, because obviously, you know, still having to do more with less, but, you know, I think the conversation needs to be had.
What would you like to see happen if Fabian had the panacea, the silver bullet at his disposal? What's the solution you would like?
I think that there's a lot of people who live in vehicles who actually want to live more sustainably. There's, as I think a lot of people in Bristol do, and then there's a kind of a craving for community, which, for example, Hamilton House provided as a place, as a hub. Mm-hmm. And I think these projects that we can acknowledge have been supported in European countries, say Germany and France and Belgium, you know, there's kind of like these projects which are sort of funded by the municipality and their community projects, and a lot of them started off as squats. And I think these can be like essentially like places to have conversations, because when you actually have a place where people can go, things become a bit more real. I think the conversations between the council and the people who live in vehicles needs to happen. And I think that Vehicles for Change as a group, as an organised group that are now a CIC, is perhaps quite a good dialogue to happen. And I think that ideally there would be some land appointed which could be managed and run, you know, in a way that would suit everyone, I'd say.
Yeah. I would say the way to start this conversation is to have the conversations with your ward councillors, where you're based, where your vans are, have those conversations and go from there. I mean, there's a lot of us have regular surgeries. You know, turn up, have the chat, have the conversation. That would be where I'd start.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Thank you both for your time. Where can we find your social media presences if we would like to find more out about the Community Interest Company?
If you go to Patreon, you can type in Vehicles for Change and that will show you the Patreon page. And then on Facebook, if you type in Bristol Vehicle Dwellers or Vehicles for Change, you'll find the Facebook page.
Thank you, Jay. I wish you a happy summer.
Thank you.
Time for some more music, boys and girls. We're going to talk international after Florence and the Machine.
You hit me once, I hit you back. You gave a kick, I gave a slap. You smashed a plate over my head. Then I set fire to our bed. Once I hit you back, you gave a kick, I gave a slap, you smashed a plate over my head, and I set fire to our bed. Oh, my black eye casts no shadow, your red eye sees no blame. Your slaps don't stick, your kicks don't hit, so we remain the same. Blood sticks, sweat drips, break the lock if it don't fit. A kick in the teeth is good for some, a kiss with a fist is better.
Florence and the Machine, Kiss with a Fist. That's especially for Harvey Weinstein, who faced justice this week. Unlucky for him. It's the Politics Show. I'm sitting in for Tony. Billy Quain is my name. Contact us, studio at bcfmradio.com, or indeed you can hit us on text message 60777. Start it with BCFM. It will come straight through to me here in the studio. Also in the studio, and we're now going to talk about the Labour leadership election campaign, Martin Summers, councillor Fabian Breckles, and Dr. David Jewell of televisual fame from GPs Behind Closed Doors. David, how does fame sit comfortable on your shoulder?
That's a mean question. I was at a concert in the summer, I think, I can't remember. And somebody came up to me and said, "Are you a doctor?" And you always think when somebody comes up and says, "Are you a doctor?" they're going to either engage you in some personal and difficult conversation or ask you to go and look after somebody. I said, so slightly shamefacedly, I said, "Yes, why?" He said, "Oh, I've seen you on television." but I'm pleased to say not many people do that. And most of the people who seem to see me are people I know from other, you know, nobody else comes up to me. Okay. The interesting part of it, there were the two very interesting parts of this experience. One of them was that the company that did the program really handled it well. They'd got themselves organized so that the way in which they approached patients and the way in which they got everybody to agree to be filmed was fantastic. But the second thing was, when I saw myself doing things on the television, I did a lot of very odd things on the television, which seemed to amuse some people anyway.
Did you think that you didn't look like yourself? Because when I started making radio programs, I was convinced I didn't sound like myself.
No, I mean, one of the things about general practice, and I don't think it's true in other bits of medicine, but we are very used to doing role plays and watching ourselves at work. It's absolutely fundamental bit of the training. I've been doing it for years and years and years. And so the cameras that were filming us were very small and discreet. You really didn't notice those at all. And so I was just being myself. And these daft things I'd saw myself doing did look just like me. I'm sorry to have to tell you.
Well, I'm sure your patients will be relieved that you looked just like yourself.
But none of us sound like what we think we sound like. You know, we're so used to your own voice from within your own head. And when you hear a recording of your own voice, you think, do I really sound like that?
Yeah, yeah.
We all do that.
I wish I made clearer, more concise sentences. That's the feedback I gave myself for years. And then I just gave up and I thought, I'll ask Martin Summer some questions because he always gets to the point quite quickly. Martin, let's talk about Labour leadership. I am of a trenchant belief. The leader of the opposition is the most important job in the political life of this country, because none of us as taxpayers, until we're elected representatives, can hold the government to account. And that is the most important facility of the establishment, is to hold them to account in their own chamber.
Well, obviously it's a very important decision because of the electoral system that we have and so on. I haven't made up my mind how I'm going to cast my vote, in fact. I've been talking to Thangam Debonair, who's my local MP, who I met this morning just by accident. And what I was stressing to her is I want to see a commitment to changing the electoral system, which is what we were discussing off air earlier on.
Yeah.
Because in actual fact, as you know, more people voted for parties which wanted a second referendum on the EU deal than voted for the Tory government, which has now got a majority of 80. And they're going to crash us out probably in this time next year from the EU, but a majority of people voted against it. And that's just not right. And, of course, the Labour leadership needs to actually... In New Zealand, the Labour Party pushed for PR in the early 1980s. So you had a right-wing Labour government, which carried out lots of Thatcherite policies, but the grassroots of the Labour Party weren't having that. They knocked on every door in New Zealand and said, we want a referendum on PR. They got a referendum on PR. They won it. And now you've got a different political setup in New Zealand where the Labour Party governs in coalition with New Zealand First and the Greens. And therefore, it's a totally different setup.
I have to admit, I've been an electoral reformer for as long as I've known there are other ways to vote for people than first past the post. Because for me, first past the post is such a negative system. If you're in a seat where your party has absolutely zero chance of getting elected, your vote doesn't count. Or do you vote for the least worst or whatever? Mm. You need, you know. I joined the Labour campaign for electoral reform within weeks of joining the Labour Party. I'm also in the Electoral Reform Society. And I just, you know, we need a proper democracy. We're the only country in Europe that still has first past the post. Even France, you get a two-stage vote. It's not, you know, and everyone else seems to manage perfectly well with PR. They're the odd blip, like Belgium, you were mentioning off air.
Belgium, multinational state, so you're going to have problems because it's not clear that the two parts of Belgium want to be in the same state anyway. So that's going to cause difficulties.
And another problem, like with Israel, they've got such a pure system of PR. It's very easy for if you fall out with somebody to go and set up your own political party. You only need a 3.5% threshold. And you've got representation.
Yeah, but it's a system in which Palestinians under occupation get no vote. So, in other words, what they're talking about now in this deal of the century is that Israeli citizens of Palestinian origin will be pushed into a Palestinian rump state so that they won't be able to vote in Israeli elections. Now, in other words, all of these questions about democracy depend on what we're talking about. So, we're talking about the Irish election earlier. I mean, who gets to vote in an Irish election? Not Ulster Unionists, of course, because they don't want to be part of United Ireland and so on. So all of these questions are always there, mm. underlying, you know, the democratic system in any country.
Yeah. Okay, so we started talking about the Labour leadership campaign, and we're now on to Israeli proportional representation. Dr. David Jewell, I'm not going to swear or ask even what your political allegiances are, but you must be taking more than a passing interest in who is the next leader of the opposition.
I haven't been a member of the Labour Party for many years, and so I don't have a vote. And I just watch on from a position of relative detachment. I mean, you said earlier, Billy, that you thought that the leader of the opposition was the most important position because it was his job or her job to hold the government to account. Now, my view is rather different. It's Parliament's job to hold the government to account, and we've seen in the recent past, numerous examples where Parliament has signally failed to do its job in that way. They did just in an extraordinary way in the dying days of Theresa May's government. They did actually hold the government to account. And what was obvious is that they didn't know how to do it properly because they'd never had that power and they couldn't organise themselves. It was absolutely fascinating.
I think what didn't help the sort of, you know, the opposition group parties was that there was a lot of, you know, like the Lib Dems were saying, oh, we'll work with you, we don't like your leader. And they said that with the last leader we had and the leader before. And, you know, at the end of the day, a party picks its leader, they pick their leader, and if you have to work together to get something done, that's what you have to do. And you just have to lump it. You know, we can't tell the Lib Dems what leader to have, and they can't tell us what leader to have. There was a lot of that kind of stuff going on, which didn't help.
Yeah, no, I accept that. I think it is more fundamental. I mean, I'm completely with you that electoral reform for the House of Parliament, for the House of Commons, is essential.
Yeah.
But actually, it's only the first bit of a whole slew of constitutional changes. What are we doing with an unelected House of Lords? What on earth? I mean, that stops the House of Lords doing its job or doing the job that they could do for it.
They don't have a House of Lords in New Zealand, and they don't have a City of London. They don't. You know, this is because they were able to bring PR in because it's such a small place.
Mm. Well, I
would be in favour of having two chambers, and I'd have them elected on slightly different lines.
Yeah.
And give them particular roles in terms of holding the government to account.
That's a very interesting idea. I mean, I think we could replace the House of Lords with the Senate of about 350-ish people. Mm-hmm. That would be a sensible size. And there's one idea that Billy Bragg came up with, which is actually quite an interesting one. He was thinking about secondary mandates. So what happens is, once you've had your election in the House of Commons, you allocate the seats in the Senate based on the proportion of votes won the Commons. Mm. So you could do it that way. But he was then saying you don't need PR in Westminster in the House of Commons, and I think you definitely do.
Let's not forget the Lib Dems, when mm-hmm. they were in coalition with David Cameron's government, they tried to steamroll through some electoral
reform.
They were
shafted.
When you say they were shafted, I mean, it was a trade-off, like any coalition government is. We will grant you this thing on electoral reform, and you stand by us when we say university fees are now £9,000.
Let me give you some feedback on that referendum. The referendum was on AV. The alternative vote, it is not a proportional system. It's used for the lower house in Australia. So it is a tried and tested, but it is not proportional representation.
I'm not sure you can use Australia as a particularly shining example of an effective democracy.
Right, but the point being that, you know, the Lib Dems were supposed to have wanted proportional representation, and they actually agreed to a referendum on something that definitely wasn't proportional representation. Add to that, a lot of the material that came out was pretty dire. You know, the whole thing wasn't, you know. And, yeah, so it was lost, but, it didn't go anything like far enough. We need a proper proportional system. There are tried and tested proportional systems, single transferable vote, the additional member system. There are systems out there that countries have been using for decades.
Including Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Absolutely.
And ourselves in the European Parliament.
And when we elect the mayor in Bristol, there's a one transfer vote.
It's a supplementary vote.
A one transfer. Interesting.
It's called the supplementary vote. You have a first and second preference.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Because, you know, sometimes you like cheese or sometimes you like ham. That's essentially the choice I was given when I turned up in Knock, of all places. Anyway, enough about me. Let's talk about the new Labour leader. Lisa Nandy is the surprise package. There were four strong women on the ticket. Were you surprised to see so few men?
I think you know, it was inevitable that Rebecca Long Bailey was going to put the hat in the ring. I was hoping Keir Starmer would. I was also hoping David Labby would. I think he's an incredibly articulate and strong man. I'm very, very clear in explaining things. You know, watching him on the TV after the general election, you know, the way he just accepted, you know, that, yes, we are leaving now, the way the vote's gone, we're leaving and that's it. You know, he was able to explain that in a very calm and measured and articulate way. But Keir, I think, is our best chance for winning the next election. And for me, that's what we have to be focusing on, because, you know, poverty will continue with this government. People will continue to die because they can't feed themselves. You know, that will continue until and unless we get into power and can start to turn the ship around. It won't be something we can't just flick a switch and turn it around overnight. It will take a while. And what we're going to inherit now in 2024, if we win, is going to be a country in a far worse state than it was in, say, 97. And there was enough to put right then. This is going to be quite drastic. What we're going to have to try and address, the levels of poverty and inequality, the way the country's so in ease with itself, the state of the health service, is it going to be sold off to the Americans by then? How do we make healthcare accessible to everyone again, if that's the case? You know, it's going to be really, really tough. But if we don't win then people will continue, you know, the people at the bottom of the ladder will continue to suffer.
Will the Labour Party remain as the Labour Party as we know it? Because there has been significant factionalism revealed throughout Jeremy Corbyn's tenure as Labour leader.
I hope so. I mean, I have been a little bit, you know, some of the stuff on Facebook, you know, some of the arguments people are putting for backing certain candidates or trying to not, or opposing certain candidates aren't helpful. I think, yeah, if we, you know, I mean, I, you know, we need to remain, we've always been a broad coalition of people from varying positions within the left. And under the first past the post voting system, that's the only way you're going to get a centre-left government elected. PR allows for other options, but that's what we will have to win the next election under first past the post. There's no way the Tories are going to suddenly introduce fair voting. So we need to be thinking about pulling together a bit of compromise. You know, I'm going to have, you know, I've got to put the needs of the people who need a Labour government ahead of my particular personal pet projects that I'd like to see a Labour government deliver. There are some essential things we've got to do. We've got to restore the National Health Service. We've got to tackle housing. We've got to deal with climate change. There is a Labour's Green New Deal. There's even a Green New Deal in Bristol that we've been working on. You know, so there's stuff that we will have to do. We're going to have to address climate. We're going to have to address poverty. You know, and we can't do that in opposition. So we have got to pull together. Otherwise,
Can I just say, I think that the debate has actually been conducted in a fairly comradely fashion. I don't think Billy's picking up that there are different factions, but in actual fact, I think that we've all we're all sadder and wiser, because of course the attempts to remove Jeremy Corbyn by a sort of clique of Labour MPs did not help and created a kind of tension. But then, of course, Corbyn overplaying his own hand in various ways created, and you know, you've got to accept when you've lost an election that you can't carry on. And I think, you know, I'm actually, what I was talking about PR earlier, so my vote could either go to Rebecca Long Bailey or to Keir Starmer. I've got the ballot sitting at home to, and what I'm trying to get from either of them is commitment to constitutional reform. that's what I want to see. But in actual fact, neither of them are actually talking about it. Although I've talked to Thangam, who's the local MP here. She's on Keir Starmer's election campaign.
Yep.
So she obviously has his ear. And I said to him, can you talk to him about this? Because, I mean, Tony Blair the other day was saying, we may have to form a coalition with the Liberal Democrats.
Martin, I'm shocked that you're even listening to a word coming out of that man's mouth.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that if the right of the party can... if the Labour Party is led by a constitutional reformer, we can then say we're moving forward either way and we can pull people in from the right and the left because we're going to change the way we play football.
Are you optimistic, genuinely, all three of you, about the future of healthy opposition in the UK, by which I mean a newly re-energised Labour Party?
I think it depends on who wins. I did go to the hustings, and yes, the hustings was Comrade Lee, but, you know, I don't think Rebecca Long-Bailey will pull the party together in such a unifying way that perhaps Keir Starmer could.
But they're all saying that whoever wins, we're all going to be in the shadow cabinet. Rebecca Long-Bailey will have a role in Keir Starmer's shadow cabinet.
I've no problem with that.
I've got no problem with it either.
Okay.
And so I think we're starting to see the shape of the team we want to play.
David, yeah. are you getting an impression of people feathering their increasingly smaller nests?
I'm not going to answer that one. But you asked just a moment ago whether one was optimistic, whether I was optimistic or not. And I hadn't really thought about that. But here's the scenario. We've got a Prime Minister that, as far as I can gather, nobody trusts and is frequently absent without leave. And the opportunity... The opportunity for somebody to take him on and reveal his duplicitousness and his mendacity.
Oh, good word, David.
And really make a fight of it, despite his large majority. The opportunity's there.
Well, yeah. Keir Starmer was Director of Public Prosecutions. And he's basically incredibly brainy and forensic barrister.
Yes.
That's another reason why he needs to be our choice. And, you know, I don't know whether you've joined the Labour campaign for electoral reform yet as a party member.
I've always been a member of it.
Cool. Excellent. Great to hear it. But, you know, I think, you know, he is, as far as I can see, without a doubt, the one who is the most likely to be able to shred Boris Johnson. And that's what we have to do.
I am thinking in those terms myself, actually.
Okay.
And then Angela Rayner as deputy, I think, will be the best, because that's the
Angela
North
Rayner,
South.
Angela Rayner, who's very friendly with Rebecca Long-Bailey, the deputy leadership, definitely, that's a shoe-in.
And she's a good candidate. Yeah.
Angela Rayner is my first preference for deputy, no question.
It's important. So we'll see what happens, because it's coming to a head pretty soon, actually, the
4th of April.
Yeah, so that's soon. Only 3 days after Fool's Day, so who knows. We need to move on, because we need to cram a lot of stuff into the last 10 minutes of today's broadcast.
Okay.
Shame on me for letting it run over as far as we did. David, you brought it up. In fact, even Martin, I think you mentioned the Israeli parliament. Netanyahu has been a naughty, naughty boy, and there is continued unease in the Middle East with renewed bloodletting on the Turkish-Syrian border this week. Trump pulled the American troops out of Kurdistan recently. Needless to say, Assad and the Russians decided to fill the vacated territories. Turkey didn't really like that so much, so they started pushing some of their troops over the pre-existing Turkish border into Kurdistan, and now it's all kicking off. At the root of all of this is some really fudged British diplomacy at the Treaty of Versailles. So, what do we do about it?
Well, I mean, what you do about it is very difficult, because a lot of these things are, as you say, 100 years old and more. So all of these, you know, the history is just keeps coming back and doesn't go away, does it? I mean, the State of Israel was set up as the Balfour Declaration, then created in 1948 and agreed boundaries by the UN, which the Israelis have never accepted. I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia during the 1990s, and we went to war with Serbia, killed 10,000 people, mostly civilians, so that they couldn't have Kosovo.
But they had blue helmets on, so that wasn't
actual. No, they didn't have blue helmets on at that stage. The blue helmets were there, but when we went to war over Kosovo, that was a NATO attacking Serbia. And because the Security Council, the Russians, were not happy about that at all, but they weren't overruled. NATO just took no notice of them at that stage. And of course, the people who didn't support that was the Ariel Sharon government in Israel, because they could understand we're now establishing a precedent where you cannot do land grabs in the 21st century, otherwise you end up in a major war. And that's why the Israelis didn't support NATO intervention in Yugoslavia.
But they seem to have gotten their hands on the Golan Heights easily enough.
Well, they got that in 1973, and it's now been accepted by the Americans that they're allowed to have that. But that's nobody else apart from the Americans and the Israelis accept that they've got the Golan Heights. And the Syrian government, which won a democratic election in 2014, largely ignored in the Western media, they said, well, we're definitely getting the Golan Heights back no matter how long it takes.
Okay.
Belongs to us.
David, you have on-the-ground experience in Palestine, and, you know, this is you coming from a healthcare background. What do you see and what are your experiences of the occupied territories?
The experience of going there is extraordinary, that people are resilient and get on with life and, generally speaking, they're not leading a normal existence because the occupation stops them doing that. But they're leading worthwhile existences and bringing up families and doing things that everybody wants to do. And that's really quite extraordinary. But the occupation is certainly, it's always there. It's always there. Everywhere you travel, you have to go through checkpoints. The checkpoints are manned by rather bored-looking teenagers, Israeli military.
Well, yeah, who are obligated to do their military service.
And somebody pointed out to me, an Israeli doctor pointed out, he said, oh yes, but just be careful. They're not the brightest ones. The really clever recruits they send for tank duty to the Negev, but the others finish up doing their border duty in the thing. And the checkpoints, on the whole, I mean, I've been very lucky. I have never been there when there's been trouble. And so the checkpoints, usually on the whole, you just get waved through. When something goes wrong, the whole country just shuts down completely. They stop all the checkpoints. Nobody can move. And the people we work with, one of the problems they have is we say, well, come and have a class in this place. And the distances are tiny. And you have to let them go home by a certain time because they're frightened that they just won't get home otherwise. It's that kind of everyday reality, which I think is really makes life difficult for them.
I must admit, I went over there March last year, and we went in. We were talking. It was a fact-finding trip, so we were talking to Israeli politicians on the left. We went to the West Bank. We went down to near Gaza. Unfortunately, it wasn't safe to go into Gaza, but we went into the West Bank, and that was quite an eye-opening. You start to realise how many shades of grey there are there. Mm-hmm. You know, like the Palestinians haven't had an election for about 12 years. There's been no penalty, you know. Obviously, the Israeli government's got Netanyahu rather than some of the more humane leaders they've had before. You know, I mean, in the council, we're involved in a project called EcoPeace, and we're looking at sort of, you know, getting involved with some kind of water aid project, which would be for, you know, working on providing water for Israel, you know, Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. So, you know, cross-border, you know, working with people from all those nations.
Which is a noble aspiration, but with a...
What I would say is there are people over there in Israel who do still want a two-state solution. Palestine's sort of divided up, the West Bank is divided up to three sort of kinds of land, isn't it? There's the there's one type which is completely controlled by the Palestinian Authority. There's controlled by the Palestinian Authority, but Israel controls the military on that land, and there's completely controlled by Israel. So, and that can cause all kinds of bureaucratic problems.
My view, and I think this is a very pessimistic view. I say to people, this is the occupation is a disaster for the Palestinians. But actually, the occupation is awful for Israel. It corrupts them. And that until lots of Israelis recognize that and decide that they need to get out for the good of their own country, until that happens. And, of course, the real problem is vast numbers of settlements if they were to decide to do that.
And, of course, those settlements, you know, some of the settlements are actually illegal under Israeli law. Never mind anyone else's law.
I am aware of Ofcom investigations into this very programme, so we need to shift the focus. Let's talk about what's going on in India at the moment, because there is a very populist, very pro-Hindu set of legislation coming in preventing Muslims from three adjoining countries entering India very easily. There is bloodletting on the streets. Britain kind of, well done Mountbatten, for 6 weeks of quick negotiation and then a trail of blood with a million dead in the following 12 months. There's blood on British hands for this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, India was sort of run on a divide and rule where the British Empire sort of pitched Muslim against Hindu and vice versa. And the Christians in India got stuck in the middle. And then, you know, you now have a situation, in, you know, obviously there's a divide, as you said, you know, Pakistan and India. Christians are on the receiving end of a lot of discrimination in both countries. You know, we're talking about India. Hindu nationalist gangs, you know, subject Christians to violence and anti-conversion laws, and, you know, so yes, this current legislation is against the Muslims, and there's millions and millions of Muslims in India, but, you know, it's also, there's also violence against Christians in India as well, and discrimination, and, you know, that country should have been a melting pot of tolerance, or could have been, and...
Well, it had been until the British got there.
I'm not at all sure I agree with that, Billy. That's really, really...
There would have been tensions. There were tensions before, and I'm sure there would have been tensions before, but we didn't exactly help when we could have done.
Okay, let's talk about another arbitrarily drawn British border. Northern Ireland is going to get quite spicy soon.
Mm.
Well, I mean, obviously, because of the Brexit stuff, all of this stuff's come to a head. But in many ways, I think what's interesting in Northern Ireland is the Alliance Party, or a cross-party, you know, cross-community party, have done very well. And there's overwhelming support for remaining in the EU in Northern Ireland. Mm. And in actual fact, interestingly enough, they had when Stormont met the other day, they all voted against the deal that that Boris has done with the, for different reasons, but they all voted unanimously against the deal that Boris Johnson's come back with.
Yeah.
And that's because it's a different country from Britain with a different political history.
It is. I know he's got Flowers in there, Brandon Flowers, who has sharp elbows and very little between his ears, so I think there's going to be blood. Anyway,
I hope not. I hope
cheerful,
I
mean, fellow.
The peace process, the Northern Ireland peace process, which, you know, was started by John Major, finished by us.
Mm-hmm.
We can't put that at risk.
20 years of peace and prosperity. It's interesting to see how long it will last under this administration. Thank you all. It's been a ding-dong. I wish you every success with the election, Fabian.
Thank you,
David. Thank you very much, Martin. I'm back next week. We're going to have Tim Kent from the Lib Dems and Afzal Shah from Labour. I've been Billy Quain. Have a great weekend.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.